Welcome to Education Perspectives. I am your host, Liza Holland. This is a podcast that explores the role of education in our society from a variety of lenses. Education needs to evolve to meet the needs of today and the future. Solving such huge issues requires understanding. Join me as we begin to explore the many perspectives of education. Today we have with us Barnett Berry. He currently serves as a senior research fellow at the Learning Policy Institute and a senior advisor for What School Could Be, while also supporting efforts to ignite student-led learning. He especially supports the empowerment of the teaching profession required for it. Barnett's work with the National Commission on Teaching and America's Future led to his founding of the Center for Teaching Quality in 2000. And for 19 years, the nonprofit focused on igniting a bold brand of teacher leadership, essential for an effective and equitable system of public education. His two books, Teaching 2030 and Teacherpreneurs, Innovative Teachers Who Lead But Don't Leave, frame a bold vision for the profession's future. In 2021, Barnett was honored by the National Board for Professional Teaching Standards with the James A. Kelly Award for Advancing Accomplished Teaching. He currently serves on several advisory boards dedicated to transforming educational systems, including the University of Kansas's Center for Reimagining Education, the Digital Promise Global Cities Education Network, and Next Education Workforce Initiative of the Arizona State University. So, Dr. Barnett Berry, welcome to Education Perspectives.
Oh, great to be with you, Liza. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm excited about our discussion today. You have such a broad background, especially in kind of the education reform field. I'm looking forward to digging in today. So let's kick off with my first question to every guest. From a 30,000-foot view, why do you think that we as a society invest in education?
Well, it's really important for democracy. Go back to our founders, Washington, Madison. Don't quote me for quoting even Madison correctly here, but I believe he said something like, a popular democratic government without popular information and a means of acquiring it would be like a recipe for disaster, tragedy. And I will say, I think we're seeing the ill effects of not fully educating the whole child, the whole human being, like we could be doing in this country. We surely do it in places, but yes, democracy, education, preparing now young people for jobs that haven't been created, haven't been imagined yet, social cohesion, civic engagement, all those important things to keep us healthy and our economy moving and peace and harmony amongst us all, right?
Hear, hear. Absolutely. So education can often be a bit of a calling. What drew you to the education field?
Well, I kind of had roots in some days as a, believe it or not, as a basketball player. And I'm dating myself now. My first years of high school was the first years of significant integration of schools in the South. A mere 16 years after the Brown decision, I was a ninth grade point guard on a basketball team that was probably the only fully integrated anything in what was supposed to be the first year of integrated schools. But in most cases, Black kids were in one classroom, white kids were in another. And when some civil unrest unfolded, it was the basketball team that came together and with support from the Urban League, did a lot of healing work in light of what had happened on our campus at AC Flora High School in the 1970s. And I think it was there that I really saw the power of public education. And one thing led to another, and I got connected to teachers who cared deeply about kids but were not supported in ways that they needed to be. And the next thing you knew, I was a teacher in an urban high school in Columbia, South Carolina.
Well, you have taken that very powerful beginning and kind of parlayed that into some really interesting areas. Do you want to tell us about, and please feel free to add in additional here and whatnot, but I know that you founded the Center for Teaching Quality and we're doing that for about 19 years. So tell me a little bit more about what made you feel like that was necessary and what impact you feel like you might have made with it?
So I will kind of leap from the 80s when I was early 1980s, when I was this high school teacher who felt very ill prepared to teach very large classes of kids, many of whom were not able to read whatever textbooks or other curriculum materials that were at my disposal as a social studies teacher back then. But from that point, when I 3 years into my teaching, by the way, with a kind of a sociology degree, not kind of a sociology degree under my belt, I kind of quickly saw that if we could have created a more dysfunctional system of teacher development and teacher support in our schools, we could not have done a better job. And that led me to graduate school. Mm-hmm. To study the profession that I will say, Liza, that I fled. I'm working some amazing teachers in Fayette County right now. December 7th, amazing group of teachers and other administrators there. I never became the really stellar teachers that those folks have become. But what I learned in graduate school is that we could change the profession. Other professions have evolved over time and have built ways to ensure quality control amongst the ranks, to ensure that practices are evidence-based, and that we have strong cohesion amongst the members of the profession to ensure that we're doing the best job together for the benefit of the ultimate beneficiaries, the kids, parents, and the communities. That's the ideal model of professionalism. And teachers have been marginalized in their efforts to professionalize over the years.
Yes, they have.
I studied much of the underlying causes, led me to studying teaching policies, studying the conditions under the work that teachers taught, and how and why it was still kind of the reality that, you know, even in the late 1990s, and then in the first part of the 21st century, the sociologists would still be calling teachers a semi-profession. And right around the time that No Child Left Behind was passed, and many more policies kind of dumping on teachers became more of the targets of reform as opposed to be leaders of reform, I kind of end up building this nonprofit, leaving my university professorship at the time behind, and to build this nonprofit to both advance teaching policies, but do so not just with evidence-based strategies and so forth, but to work directly with some of the nation's best teachers in finding solutions to the most vexing problems that they are facing. So the Center for Teaching Quality, which had a run of about 19 years, was kind of built upon that premise. And I'm very proud of what we got done for many steps forward that we have made over the years. And I will say we have made some progress, Liza. We still have a long way to go. And it seems like for every step forward, there's many steps from side to side and occasionally a step back.
Well, I empathize with that a lot because I see exactly the same issues and conditions, and feel very lucky to be working with you right now on a deeper learning initiative here in Fayette County, Kentucky. And I think that what everyone in our society needs to realize is that teachers are experts at teaching. They may not know what they don't know about content. They may not know what they don't know about what's going on as far as what careers are out there or any of that kind of thing. But that the system that they are brought up in totally makes that happen. They're very siloed. It's very much, I had one teacher talk to me about feeling like, you know, she goes to school and she's in a box and she's literally put in a box. And the thing that we are missing, I think, in this entire equation is that teachers are taught how to teach. And the best of them are really reaching out to their students and want to customize how they teach. So we need to give teachers agency back to be able to do that. We've micromanaged them to death.
Right. But what other profession, particularly in the knowledge field, expects each practitioner to figure it out on their own in serving a multitude of needs that any number of those 30 to 35 numbers of children or adolescents in their midst have, right? If you go think about how many different industries organizing their employees to work in teams, to solve problems in a collaborative way, to come up with their own ideas and given space to investigate and test out those ideas to improve productivity or to build a new app or whatever. Or if you go into the medical field, and just not saying there are no problems there, most people can attest that that is indeed the case. But when you go into a hospital and into an operating room, you may have who knows how many different types of doctors of various expertise, training, experience. Same thing with nurses, technicians, and the like. You have a team, and hopefully you'll have a team that will follow and support you on your road to health and recovery. We could do the same thing with our schools. And here's the good thing, Liza. We are. The problem is just like in almost any aspect of what needs to be or could be done in education and with teachers, everything that needs to be done is already being done. It's just in bits and pieces. You said the word, the S word. We don't have a system to sustain the good work that teachers and principals do every day. And that's what I'm proud about Fayette, because I think the leadership from the superintendent on down is, I think, darn serious about rethinking the role of teachers and, by extension, principals to ensure that every child in Fayette graduates, you know, career and college ready, meeting that profile, which is suggests very ambitious outcomes, not just passing a standardized test around, you know, rote knowledge that is most likely doubling every 4 or 5 seconds. Now I'm exaggerating right now, but, you know, you can't even calculate how rapidly knowledge is accumulating. And now with AI and ChatGPT 4.0 and 4.5, who knows what's coming next? Well, actually, many people do know what's coming next. It is time to totally reinvent the teaching profession, and we have some tools and opportunities to do so in powerful ways.
Tell us a little bit about those bright lights. What kind of things are you seeing across the country that you would love to see spread elsewhere?
Well, I can tell you a few great stories from Fayette, but I'm going to tell you a story that I love from Anaheim, California. Great superintendent, Mike Matsuda, about 8-9 years ago, did away with a standardized test. The interim test. He had to give, obviously, the state mandated tests and the national tests that federal law requires, or the test that, standardized tests that federal law requires, of course. But he kind of did away with all those other tests that bogged so many teachers down and began to focus on what they call the 5 C's and how kids can learn and apply content through the 5 C's, you know, much like the Fayette's portrait character, compassion, communications, collaboration, critical thinking, and the like, right? Okay. So, and they've done a lot of cool things, including creating a number of hybrid teacher roles. So teachers are teaching part of the day and the other part of the day, helping their colleagues think differently, act differently, and teach differently, and innovate on their own accord. So here's a biology teacher, Sabina, a few years back, working with her kids, utilizing a small garden outside her classroom at Magnolia High School there in Anaheim in the shadow of Mickey Mouse. By the way, a community that serves, I mean, large majorities of homeless families, as well as the community is really abuts a food desert, right? So the next thing you know, Sabina is talking to the superintendent and they have an idea. Actually comes from both the teacher and some of her students, because there's like 3 acres on the backside of the property of the school. The next thing you know, as part of their community school movement, they have a working farm.
Nice.
Of course, the superintendent worked with her to help raise money to do some very cool things to really advance the development and cultivation of the farm, where kids are not only involved in the production of crops, where they're learning all kinds of things about science, biology, botany, et cetera, right? The math teachers are using all kinds of opportunities to use great practical ways to use their experiments and so forth to learn important concepts there as well. But the kids are also learning how to feed the community, and they're learning how to market, become entrepreneurs, their products. That is the kind of innovation that comes from teachers when they have time and space that a district like Anaheim created for this particular teacher. And there's great numbers of examples like that in that district and elsewhere.
Well, and that gives the kids purpose, too. They totally see a practical application. They have food on their plates, that which they may not have had because of what they're doing in school.
And they're learning how to market their food. They're learning all kinds of skills.
Oh, that's so amazing.
Yeah, everything that needs to be done is being done somewhere. It's just we don't have a system in place to ensure that every kid has access to high quality teaching and learning and opportunities to thrive in this uncertain future that lies ahead, I guess.
Well, that's part of what you mentioned earlier about this particular leader, that you get what you measure for. And if we're still measuring for things that really are not aligned with what we need for today and for the future, we're going to continue to have challenges in our schools. But it takes some really great leadership. Like you said, we're starting to see in Fayette County. It's so exciting to me because the right people are on the right bus going in the right direction, and we're all kind of rowing together. And that's so exciting. It feels like magic is happening. But tell me, as you have been doing this with other groups, and you know, obviously, maybe you have attracted some of the good unicorns out there of the good work that's being done everywhere. But you were talking about systems, and systems can be very much of a drag on any type of innovation if they are not modified to be able to, you know, kind of set the course and allow it to run without obstacles. Can you tell me a little bit about what kind of challenges you have faced and what you would like for leaders who maybe have not gotten into this space to know?
Well, there is this myth that the educators on the ground are not capable of fueling system change. And there is absolutely no fact behind that. I'm going to turn to an example from overseas in what you find routinely in top performing education jurisdictions across the globe. There are at least two pieces of the puzzle, and there's, you know, multiple ones, and there's no silver bullet, but there's two pieces of the puzzle that these top performers tend to have that we don't find routinely in the United States when it comes to building and maintaining system change. One is, most importantly, there is really significant intentionality around promising practices that can be found in one school or in one district. There's intentionality about putting resources into those places so those practices can move to other places. They don't migrate on their own. There's got to be some intentionality about how it goes from point A to point B. And oftentimes, the school over here that's doing something really well that needs to move something over there, it's a school that has assets and strengths as well that could also benefit the school that just sent them those promising practices. So there's got to be intentionality about how promising practices move from place to place in those countries. And Singapore is probably the best example, but you see it in Finland, you see it in Estonia, and a number of other jurisdictions. The other one, Liza, that is, I think, really important, there's got to be some proportion of teachers, much like you find in the tech industry, who are afforded some, what the people in the private sector call white space. Here's your job. Yeah, but maybe for some portion of your time, this week, this month, this year, you get time off from your routine work that you need to accomplish to innovate with you, with your colleagues. And I think if we started thinking about staffing schools differently, mm-hmm. you start thinking about teaming teachers. So it's not one teacher, one classroom for those 30 kids solely. Teams of educators. And now think about the introduction of AI-generated tutors that can save teachers time, also can provide the right kind of personalization for some kids that free up teachers' time to really do more of this innovative work. Yeah, you know, if you think about it, we can do this. And by the way, I want to give a shout out to my friends at Arizona State University and the Next Education Workforce Initiative, where they are probably the most serious effort I've seen in quite some time to kind of push this country and its school systems away from the one teacher, one classroom model. So I encourage your listeners and viewers to check out the work that Carol Basile, the dean there, and Brent Madden, the executive director of that initiative, and what they're trying to do to help us kind of break through that Gordian knot, so to speak, of how we organize teachers.
Excellent. I'll make sure to put that in our show note. That's exciting. And it is definitely kind of paradigm shifting, because our classrooms have looked the same for a lot of years. But some of the most exciting teachers that I've been interviewing have been given that space to be able to take innovation cross classrooms and even cross disciplines, to be able to work off each other's strengths and really do some neat, enriching, engaging experiences for kids. Because I think especially as you get to that middle and high school age, we're not doing a good enough job of engaging the kids and helping them to understand why they need to be learning this. I literally had a kid tell me, you know, that entire class I could have learned in a 15-minute YouTube video. And, you know, we've got to up our game. We have to up our game to be able to prepare the kids for the future that they're actually going to be living in. And you mentioned AI earlier, and I think there's a tremendous opportunity there. I know it scared a lot of educators, but tell me about your thoughts about AI.
Well, you know, I think it is a rightfully scary, given what is potential there in terms of dehumanizing. I'm going to just speak to how some entrepreneurs who see dollar signs lighting up in their eyes, and how AI could do things that at a much lower cost than a teacher could do. On the other hand, I see systems thinking very smartly about these matters already and beginning to see that what AI can do is begin to free up teachers for the more creative work that we need them to do, as well as having more time to build the relationship between themselves, the student, the curriculum, and the community. So I'm excited about the prospects for AI, Liza. And I'm hopeful. But let me tell you, if educators don't take control of it, somebody else will take control of it. And then it could very well be used for the wrong purposes, at least in terms of our ideals for a public education system that helps young people build purpose, find their identity, and be ready for this uncertain future.
Can you talk to us a little bit about your perspective on how important it is for students to be able to take charge of their own learning?
There's a neuroscience around this, that we actually learn things deeply when it is anchored in our own lives, when the learning activity is anchored in our own lives, and the work of learning is in concert with others in kind of what I would call more authentic opportunities for collaboration. That's where the synapses really start going off, and kids really begin, or not just kids, all humans begin to internalize and be able to use the knowledge and not just regurgitate it for a bit of time before they forget it. There's a real strong science of learning development that has been building over the last decade or so that tells us so much how important relationships are in between the teacher and the student, and the student and other and the peers, and actually what we call deeper learning. That is the mastery of more substantive knowledge and the creative use of it. That's what I consider deeper learning, of which our favorite school district here in Kentucky is deeply engaged in trying to move the needle on ensuring that every kid has opportunities to learn deeply and every teacher has opportunities to lead their own learning.
And I think that is so incredibly powerful. And, you know, even while we have these bright lights everywhere that we've been talking about, that doesn't mean that we can use the old system of cookie cutter. Okay, I'm going to take this off the shelf and bring it over to you, and this is how you have to do it step by step by step in your area, because it doesn't really work that way. Can you talk a little bit about the value of customizing learning, not only for students, but especially for teachers in what you provide for their PD?
Well, first of all, how in the heck can kids lead their own learning, take control of it, which is, by the way, what employers want them to do now, by the way. This is not just a humanistic ideal for education in a democracy. It is an economic imperative. But back line of thinking here, how in the heck can a student lead their own learning if those who are teaching them are not leading theirs? So that's the premise of why we need to totally reinvent teachers' professional learning and leadership. And that requires, first and foremost, that we know much more about what teachers know and care about. We need to figure out how to better utilize and distribute their expertise. And we need to create a lot more space for them based upon the goals that they need to achieve with their kids and their school and their community. And by the way, it's going to look a little bit differently, in some cases even very differently from place to place, even in a relatively, I'm going to say relatively small district as Fayette, which is not so small. But there's a lot of diversity there. And I think what kids need to learn and how they learn it in one place could be a lot different than another place. And teachers need to have the time and agency to figure that out together, mm-hmm. to get the supports they need, the evidence-based practices they need, opportunities to assess how well they're doing, and to hold themselves in kind of a shared accountability model for getting good stuff done on behalf of kids. If that's your model of professional development, it's not about sit and get workshops. It's not about a 30-minute every other day, I'm going to say PLC meeting, where you have someone brings in a spreadsheet and you have a few minutes to talk about this child's growth rate or versus that child's growth rate. We got to think very differently about how teachers can learn deeply about kids' trajectory and where they can go, and give them the tools and space to really support and follow that trajectory over time, which then gets us back to how we design teachers' time and space.
Yes.
And if you have a high school teacher with 250 kids a year they're teaching, or 150 kids a year, depending on whether they're on a semester schedule or a year-long schedule, I don't know how you do that at scale, Liza. I don't know how you create a kind of the right kind of professional learning that for teachers that can really help them support the learning needs of kids, and knowing those kids well when they have that many young lives that they have to know and take care of.
It's a monumental challenge, especially with that type of risk and that scale. But I think that you touched on it earlier about the opportunity to collaborate, and whether it's collaborating amongst a topic area or cross disciplines in a grade level. You know, some of that may be, hey, I really relate to Johnny and you really relate to Susie. And so you're going to take, you know, we've got some models out there that are starting that, trying to have at least one adult in every building that a child can rely on.
And then if we knew more about what teachers were good at and had a way to distribute their expertise, then every teacher wouldn't have to know everything, especially about every kid, because you are in a team. I'm going to go back to my friends at ASU in a school, a Stevenson Elementary in Mesa, Arizona, and where a fourth grade teacher had been this teaming model for a couple of years, I guess, including during the pandemic. She tells me, you know, I used to teach 25 kids in a classroom, and now I'm part of a team that works with about 110 kids. And I know 110 kids and their families better, each and every one of them better than I did when I was solely responsible for only 25 in my own classroom. She knows those kids through the work with the other six members of the team.
Right. And that knowledge sharing is so important.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Absolutely.
So I will tell you this, I got to, of course, give a shout out to my main groove now with what school could be. You know, they're working with them in supporting this opportunity to build out this system of leading teachers for student-led deeper learning here. And, you know, one of the strengths of what school could be is something that you know something about, and that's storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
As we think about the future, I don't think we need to spend as much time on conducting more research, even though we do need to study what we do and assess progress. But we've got to find the powerful evidence-based examples of where this is working right now, particularly in the district. And we're already beginning to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We got to tell the story.
Yes.
At the end of the day, what's going to move people from a policymaker to a parent, to a teacher, to an administrator, to a business leader, to a community and faith leader, to rally around a new vision for teaching and learning is not just the numbers on a spreadsheet.
Mm-hmm.
Or an improvement in a test score. It's going to be that evidence-based narrative of the lived experience of particularly a young person and the educators who are serving them that's going to move people to kind of take the leaps in order for us to go from, quite frankly, this still last vestiges of the factory model of teaching and learning to something that, quite frankly, could totally revolutionize the way we think about schooling and the future of public education in America.
You know, and honestly, we are moving in a society that is changing in such a fast-paced way. We have to not look at public education as just this period of time. It's got to be building lifelong learners who know how to process information, who know how to critically think about it and assess it. And that process piece is becoming more and more important because content, man, it's in your iPhone. And no, the vision needs to be so broad, and that's so hard in such a bureaucratic system. So we got to go small to go big, I guess.
Yes, there's an adage that's been used in the improvement science world, kind of both healthcare and to some extent in education. And I really like this. Think big, start small, learn fast.
I like it so much. But I would like to touch before we end our conversation a little bit on your vision for asset mapping, because I just think that's a brilliant piece and it's a different way of looking at things that leaders might really benefit from.
Well, first of all, I will tell you there are some extraordinary activist scholars out there who've done a lot of work in what's called social network analysis, both in and out of education to support organizational change. What we know, and I'll just speak to education for just a bit, the quality of the ties and the relationships that teachers in particular have with each other can are critical to whether or not any innovation is going to work or not. And there are studies that show that teachers who have more quality ties with other teachers are more likely to make instructional shifts that improve student outcomes. However, there are very few systems in America that I know of that really know a great deal about the teachers in their midst.
Yeah.
So we're hoping to kind of move on an effort, and we got some terrific colleagues elsewhere around the country who I know are willing to help us, but to kind of think about, particularly with the group of teachers that we're working with right now, on particularly those that are engaged in some really significant deep learning innovations, how they learned what they learned, who they turned to advice in helping them do what they have done and continue to do. And who turns to them for advice? Just imagine if you could ask that of, in a systematic way,
mm-hmm.
of every teacher.
Absolutely.
Then you could know, particularly with new tools and technologies, you could really know who's connected to whom and who, particularly around the specific aspects of pedagogical expertise. It could be around from, you know, improving literacy rates in a building or in a classroom, to and helping kids, you know, use a variety of social science concepts to improve their community,
mm-hmm.
right? And if you had a way to assemble evidence of what kids know and can do, okay, think about this.
Yes.
And by the way, the school district's moving rapidly to elevate through performance assessments and capstones, exhibitions of kids' work. You know, we can begin to see sooner than later which teachers are good at helping kids get this learning done or this project done or accomplish this or that. we could actually know which teachers are helping these kids. And then we can help teachers who know how to do A really well, connect with teachers who know how to do B very well, and pair them up.
Exactly.
So they both know more about A and B.
Oh, I love it. And, you know, from a principal's perspective, you can see where your gaps are, too. If you have a teacher that's not connected to anybody, maybe you need to build some supports there. So, yeah, no, that is so awesome. So final parting comments for decision makers. What would you like them to be thinking about, or what would you like them to know?
Oh, my. When I think about the last 2-3 decades of reform, and this might be a bit of an overstatement, maybe not. No, it's not, I think. Teachers are the solution, not the problem. I think that would be my bottom line sort of expectation and hope. Whatever strategy they take on, look at teachers as your solution, not your problem.
That wraps this conversation up in a beautiful, beautiful bow. Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Enjoyed being with you, Liza.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Education Perspectives. Feel free to share your thoughts on our Facebook page. Let us know which education perspectives you would like to hear or share. Please subscribe and share with your friends.